Oh, hi, everybody. Susan Gabriel, the Suzmi, is here. Before we get started today, I just want to let you guys know that it was so much fun chatting with my next guest that we're going to split it up into one or two or maybe three shows. So be on the lookout after you listen to the first one for it to continue in the coming weeks.
Soul Butter, a tiny talk about big things. So much talk, so little makes sense these days. What do you do when something much wiser than the mind you use to get through a day starts talking to you? A voice beyond what's familiar. And how can you make it work for you beyond the spin in this world? Start listening today. Join Susan Gabriel from the Inside Out. With special guests, songs, students, and stories as we introduce Soul Butter, a tiny talk about big things. Light Notes from the Suzmi.
Welcome, everyone. I am Susan Gabriel, your host, the Suzmi, to this tiny talk on big things here at Soul Butter. And today we welcome Jennifer Horn. I'm very excited to say hello. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. She is a three-decade veteran of communications and as state and national GOP leader, political strategist, podcaster, author, and mother of five, and I have learned grandmother of?
Six beautiful grandchildren.
So that must keep you busy.
Very busy. Noisy house, but I love every minute of it.
Right. In this moment, we know she's also busy on the Brave platform of political currency that we're all riding in, and as co-founder, but strategist of Women for Us. There are many heroes in this moment, and I consider you to be one of them. You have to allow me to embarrass you for a few seconds.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Because of your remarkable work as a pioneer fighting to preserve all of our freedoms and preserve this wonderful democracy at this very strange moment in space and time in our history. So you have quite a story to tell, and I'd love to have you go to the heart of what has motivated you. You can grow yourself up from age five or start.
Oh, gosh.
When you got into
politics. I don't want to hear that story. I'm much too old for that.
You never know.
So,
yeah.
Well, you know, I am late to the political game for, you know, compared to most people getting involved in politics. I ran for office when I was in my mid-40s. So that, you know, that's when I really got involved in the whole political world. But even then, even with that, you know, that was in 2008, I was the nominee for Congress in the 2nd District in New Hampshire. And even then, it was a whole different world than it is now. Politics was a different world. It ran to a different tone, a different tenor. You know, we had the people, you know, voters had a different perspective on what government should be and what politics should be. There has been so much change. And as much as we would all like to blame it on Mr. Trump, you know, blame him for the change, the truth is, and what I have found the most discouraging about all of this is that you can't really blame Trump for other people, for all those millions and millions and millions of Republicans who follow him and who have embraced this MAGA mentality. And so for me, you know, I ran for Congress. I was I won the primary. I was the nominee. I became very involved. And my political hometown is New Hampshire, the state of New Hampshire, where we get all those you know, great experiences with presidential candidates as they come through the first in the nation primary. But my first encounter with the idea of Donald Trump as a candidate, as somebody who would, you know, come in and take over the Republican Party, was actually in 2011. You know, he announced his run in 2015, but he came to New Hampshire in April of 2011 during the 2012 cycle when Romney became our nominee, to kind of dip his toes in the water and see if he was interested in running or not. And I like to say that Mitt Romney scared him out of that race. But, you know, we've got to give, I don't want to give Trump any credit, but he was smart not to get involved then. The opening wasn't really there for him yet. And he knew that. And I find that to be really devious, that his ability to plan that far ahead, to read the room the way that he did, to understand that what he was going, he knew what he was going to bring to the table, and that the world just, you know, the party just wasn't quite there yet. But I blame the people for them, you know, for who they embrace. I blame the Republican elected leaders for what they allowed Donald Trump to do. He could have been rejected and eliminated at any moment along the way, starting from the day he, you know, came down that golden escalator in Trump Tower and forward. So you can't, as certainly Trump holds a lot of responsibility. He is as mean, as ugly, as corrupt, as narcissistic, as misogynistic, as racist as he seems to be. That is truly who he is. I believe very much that is who he is. But the Republican Party allowed this to happen. They weren't, you know, they weren't broadsided. They weren't, you know, he didn't kidnap them. They opened their arms to him. They embraced him. And that welcome is largely to blame for what he has become and the damage he has been able to do.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that when we consider the broader picture of where of the setup, you know, the programming and the setup and what people have given their lives to over the arc of our growing up. I've thought a lot about that. And I've thought about, I was in television news at a time that they took the word journalism out of the dictionary. By that, I mean corporate traded places with creative, and they turned news directors into supervisors of corporate policy rather than the creative, wonderful flow that we had. And I was fortunate to be on a number one team. We had a beautiful program, and there was a lot of freedom, and the we all could do what we needed to do. We were trusted. We had autonomy. We knew how to put a story together, and we didn't look at our watches. It was not transactional. That's what I'm getting at. So,
And you were trusted by the people watching you because of all of that too.
Oh, there's no question.
Right, right.
You know, there's no question. And so, is it to further go along with what you're keying into? It seems to me that when money gets into the picture, and I like money just like anybody else, but when something happens to a person, when there's a trade-off, right, a trade-off of essentials, and I kind of want to talk to you about that, because those very essentials that cause the self-betrayal that we witness with individuals and collective organisms, such as the party and entities, et cetera, those same characteristics that are surrendered are the very things that you're listening to take the actions that you've taken, Jennifer. And I would like you to speak to your road and journey. And what is it about you that has allowed you to listen to the conscience? You know, when you're growing up, somebody says, listen to your conscience, you know, you used to get promoted for that. And now you get fired for it.
And as a candidate, you used to get applauded for that. And now you get booed. You know, it's a different, you know, I grew up in a very large family. I'm one of 10 children. And it was not at all a political family. You know, we didn't even talk about politics, really. I didn't understand the nature of politics for a very long time. But we were a family that we were raised by parents who were very conscientious about teaching us about the value of good, the value of truth and integrity. My father worked in the banking industry, and he frequently talked about how honesty and integrity were non-negotiable. You know, and he worked in community banks where people would come into him, and you know, people would need to borrow money, or people would have, you know, issues. Again, this is, we're talking about my dad started in this world back in the 50s, you know, so it was a more personal relationship then than what you see with your banker today, unfortunately. And he understood how important it was to be trusted. And he would teach us that it only takes one lie or one betrayal, you know, one failure to lose the trust of somebody forever, you know, in a way that you can't ever fix it. So that, you know, those are the kinds of values, the kinds of principles that we were raised with. My mother was, you know, my mother would say, you do what's right because it's right. not because it's going to get you something, not because you're going to trade it for something else later, but because it's right. And we were also a family of faith. You know, we went to church every Sunday, and my parents very much focused their parenting from that perspective. So that's kind of the foundation for all of us in my family. I think all of my siblings are the same way, no matter what path each one of us took. And when I got involved in politics, it's not that I didn't know that politics isn't always perfect, but it didn't occur to me that the idea of being honest and straightforward would be seen as refreshing, or you know, somehow you know, somehow different than others. We all know that whether you're climbing the ladder in the corporate world or the political world or whatever world you live in, the higher up the ladder you get, the more, I want to say the more trade-offs you make. But I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way or a negative way all the time. You know, it takes time, it takes commitment, it takes dedication. And if you're dedicated to this, then you can't be dedicated 100% to something else. You know, there's a lot of trade-offs as you go through life. And I think what we've learned about politics long before Donald Trump is that people who get really high up on the ladder sometimes make some uglier trade-offs. And it's because of power. It's not about which party or which policy or which legislative effort. It is about having that power personally in your own hands. Mm-hmm. And I was never willing to make that trade. I was never willing at any point in my life, before or during politics, to make that trade. One of the things I've always said is that I would never say or do anything that I couldn't sit down at the table with my kids and explain it and defend it. Now, my kids are all adults now, and they're not at my table as often anymore, but I've tried really hard to be, as focused on honor and integrity and honesty as my mom and dad always were. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something we need more of in politics, whether it's elected representatives or activists, voters. I think, I think that voters are perennial, annually, every 4 years, I guess, disappointed. You know, how this is not the first time that we've had people complain that they're disappointed in their choices. Mm-hmm. But I really struggle with trying to understand, is the problem that the higher up on the political ladder you get, the more trade-offs you've made, maybe the more corrupt you've become, the more willing you've become to trade your personal integrity for more power? Or is the problem that all of us as an entity, as a society, have become so busy with our own lives and maybe so disgusted with the political process that we're sort of just letting it happen now? We're not fighting back enough. And that's what I think this is about. It's about fighting back against something that has become inherently corrupt and doesn't and disserves the people, and has to be saved now, or we lose it for good. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's an exaggeration. I think that's real. I think that's truth. And when you have 6 grandchildren, you think about those things from a long-term perspective. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where my brain is.
Yeah, no question about that. And do you think that, and very well put, do you think that the, is there a common thread of missing character or fractured character, let's say, by the way, not only the body politic has been affected by a malaise that is bigger than the body politic, but is really that transactional betrayal of not ancillary elements, not things that are worthy of compromise or giving up, but the things that are essential to us. That's really my focus is.
Absolutely.
It's the essentials that are damaged. That's where the damage is. That's where the damage is. And how do you, with that, how do you tie that thread then into the individual voters in all the various demographics? Let's take the demographic word out of it and just talk about human beings. What right. happens in a person, whether they, because a lot of those people are not amongst those who have big bank accounts. They're the opposite. And
the majority of them do not have big bank accounts, right? We do not have big bank accounts. It's You know, let me kind of pick that question apart into a couple different pieces. The first thing at the very beginning of those essentials that we end up giving up or that we end up losing. I think I've said this to you before, that when I finally formally left the Republican Party, it really wasn't because Donald Trump was trying to disenfranchise voters, the big lie, steal the election, instigating an insurrection. You know, as horrific as that all was, and as anti-democracy, I mean, we can talk about how damaging that is politically and culturally for hours, right? But as bad as that was, I left the party because the party was not my partner in trying to fight it. Mm-hmm. If you will recall, after the results of the 2020 election were announced, I think it was on a Friday. I think that, you know, the election was on Tuesday. And I think it wasn't until Friday that it was officially, formally called and we confirmed who won. Immediately, Donald Trump obviously exploded and his rhetoric became really dangerous and frightening. But people like Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy got right on board that, you know, big lie train immediately. The leaders of the party, these aren't people, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't naive. I knew, I had a good idea of who they were and what their character was. But they took the biggest leap and just fully embraced it. You know, the impeachment was behind us. I'm sorry, that, you know, the first impeachment was behind us. All these opportunities that they've had over 4 years to show character, to show honor, they made it so clear. Ronna Romney McDaniel, who I knew, that remains one of my great personal disappointments in all of this. The willingness of party leaders to just jump on board the lie train and the destroy democracy train so that they could cling to power. That was one of the great trade-offs that they made that I was simply not willing to have my name associated with in any manner. So, you know, when it comes to the essentials, I think in this case, I'm talking about politics, that's the worst we've ever seen in my lifetime. You know, as far as, oh gosh, I'm trying to remember the next thing you said. It was about more personal than that.
Amongst the voters and amongst what's happening. Have you noticed something's happening, you know, COVID, the pandemic, all these acupuncture type of things that have fractured elements of
right.
Our culture.
Well, and we've all seen that what we experienced, the trauma, you know, our country experienced a trauma throughout the COVID emergency. And we've all seen how that has impacted children who were in, you know, very young at the time, relationships with between family members, elderly people who died alone in nursing homes, and then the trauma that their adult children will live with for the rest of their lives because they couldn't be there. You know, all of these are really deeply impactful experiences. And we all experienced it one way or another. But that's COVID, right? That's not, by itself, that does not explain what has happened to us socially and culturally. Mm-hmm. The political world that we live in as a nation is damaging our communities. It is damaging our relationships with people that we really love, people that we care about deeply, whether it's siblings who, you know, have very different views of who, you know, voting and why they're voting the way they are, whether it's in a neighborhood and what happens to you if you put a political sign on your front lawn, not being able to even discuss politics at work anymore because you're afraid you're going to get fired or somebody's going to report you to HR for something that, you know, can't talk about it over lunch. We really live in a world where it's too scary to talk openly about politics. And if that's the case, then how do we talk openly and in a restorative, healing manner about democracy, about the individual personal impact that losing democracy will have on each of us? Not just as citizens of a democracy, but as members of a family, as neighbors, as parents who have to interact with a school system on behalf of their children, those of us who have had spent years interacting with the healthcare system on behalf of our parents. All of these things are affected financially, policy-wise, but also personally. like who we are as human beings and how we interact with other human beings. And it's something I think that we don't talk about enough. And it's something that I think when this election is over, hopefully we will start to give some more attention to. You know, it's kind of a mental health thing. It isn't necessarily, and I'm not saying that we all have mental illness, although I do think that mental health is a spectrum, you know, that we all, we sort of like our little dot moves up and down the line throughout the course of our lives. But I think that's the most, the bigger, more powerful impact that all of this is having on us as people, as a society. And I think that it's not yet getting the kind of healing attention that it needs.
Mm-hmm. And how would you say, do you sense, if I was to look at the cup half full, which is often difficult to see, because when you feel like you're drowning in all of this.
Right.
But if one was to see that the adversity, how can the adversity serve the outcome that we want in terms of,
right.
it's triggered in people that maybe weren't thinking about their, what they were, how they made their choices, or it's triggering, gosh, I gave that up, but it didn't work because now I don't even feel like a person anymore. You know, I mean, just all kinds mm-hmm. of self-awareness that might be coming to the forefront because of the adversity that it never, you cannot, you what gets fractured, and I'm not really talking about mental illness, I'm more talking about the wounding of the human spirit,
right.
that we pretend like it's poetry on the wall, and if it's in a song, we, you know, we'll buy tickets to the concert.
Yeah.
But part of my contention is what we've traded out as extracurricular could be essential to us, that the fundamentals of being a person, some people don't know they're people anymore. I mean, they don't act.
Yeah, I agree.
You know,
I agree with you completely about that. And let me just share like a little personal story with you about
please.
That. The there are a few people in my immediate family circle, and my immediate family circle is very large. I told you I'm one of 10 kids. You know, they all have partners. I've got 5 children who are either married or partnered up. And I have had more than one occasion where I realized that my relationship with somebody that I love deeply, that I care about deeply, was being damaged because of our differences over Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And I am the person in our family, in that whole big circle, who is most involved in politics, who has kind of a voice in politics. And I did not realize the degree to which the crusade that I had taken on publicly was hurting 2 or 3 people that I love very, very much.
Wow.
And so that became something that I became committed to addressing immediately upon understanding it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a good that has come out of this is that, and I hope that other families are experiencing this the same way, that no matter how important that is, democracy, activism, honor, integrity, all these things that we believe very strongly we're fighting for, nothing that I do out there is more important to me than what's happening right inside here at my dining room table, inside my house, inside my relationships. And I didn't realize that there were people in my life who thought that when I called Donald Trump racist, that I was calling them racist. Or when I said Donald Trump was a misogynist or a narcissist, that I thought they must be a misogynist and a narcissist. So it's an opportunity, if taken with care and caution, to improve communication and to open up and remind each other of our love for each other. And really strengthen some of the relationships that, you know, maybe we take for granted. We assume that the people we love know that we love them, or that the people we respect know that we respect them. And so in that way, I think, so, you know, I'm sure there's others I can talk for hours, as you know, but I think, you know, for me, that was a kind of a powerful moment, recognizing that and having the opportunity to address it.
Yeah. Cause you know, when all else, that's a wonderful story. Cause when all else fails, at, you know, by the time everybody puts down their weapons of whatever their weapons are, whether they're words or whatever they are, the sole survivor is always compassion. You know,
Right.
that's always the last person standing is compassion. Yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
And that is not, again, it's not weak. You know, it's not a weak way to roll forward in the world. And that's what I was wondering, if from the corporate transactional point of view, if in that paradigm, there's no allowance for vulnerability. And that vulnerability is the gift of being a human being, because that's what allows things to happen between people.
Well, and the big mistake is when, and what you're talking about, the corporate world, and, you know, to some degree, somebody can make the argument, well, the corporate world has an obligation to profit. The corporate world has an obligation to growth, to, you know, to certain financial measurements. And that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But, and so so people can make the argument out there in all these different industries, all these different paths, about why they are as tough as they are. And they see that as a good thing. So, you know, this toughness, we cannot afford to lose that compassion and that empathy in politics. And that is what the current GOP has already done. And it's almost what they stand for. It's what their platform is. Politics is supposed to be about people, the people, not the politicians, not the you know, the members of Congress, but the people that they're supposed to serve. And they all are very good at the language, you know, they're all good at the speeches and getting everybody riled up about how, you know, wonderful and you know, service oriented they are. But that isn't the reality of politics today in the United States. Your point about our humanity is lost in politics today. And I think that that is something that millions of Americans are not only aware of, but are fighting in 2020. And now in this cycle, again, it has kind of become a motivating factor for them fighting to retain that, to kind of, you know, when we talk about democracy, democracy is a human condition. You know, it isn't, it's a human condition before it's a political philosophy, you know, in my way of looking at it. And I think that there is something really growing in our country right now. You want to talk about the positives. I think there is a growing awareness of the humanity that is being lost in American politics right now. And I have to say, it's not just on one side of the aisle, but it is overwhelmingly, powerfully more on one side of the aisle. And I think that that is something that people are really starting to feel and beginning to understand. And I think it's becoming a real motivator for them.
That's it right there. That's the sweet spot of the whole thing. Because when I spoke to adversity, how is the adversity, what's it causing to happen? Because one thing happens that if something falls away, something else comes up, just like in a garden. You know, it's very dark down there in the dirt. What's that much is going on, but there's a lot going on. And that little acorn turns into a tree, and it's got to hurt to jump out of that shell to get that, you know. So if the suffering that has been pervasive, you know, it's so personal. You've described it beautifully. It's so personal, from the home to the friends to the person down the street to the voter to the politic, the whole thing. Essential to beholding. And before you get to, I loved it when you said this, you said it's before philosophy.
Yeah, before, it is not, it is.
Not,
it's humanity before it's political policy or political philosophy. Absolutely.
Exactly. And one of the premises of my little curriculum is that music that is heard begins in the sounds of silence, because movement is where music begins, and that's the beat of the heart. And so it's metaphorically bringing that back to what you're saying, that's what you're saying, is that it we have to have we can't leave ourselves, and we see what's happened when we have, and that's the next place I'd like to go with you. It's a little outside the box, but it's definitely in the realm of what you're focusing on. Is it's almost fascinating, the parts that we don't remember about being a human being as we go out about our day. And when you talked about the love, people think you have to love. We are love.
Right.
We are love. We
love originates in our being.
Right. We already have, and I have to remember this, we already have what we're going for. We have everything we need. It's opening up to it, to be remembered to it, having been dismembered from it. And that's where I would like to go with you in terms of your story about, and I heard Bob Woodward. I was at an event at a college, and the governor of Maryland, Wes Moore, was, they were chatting on stage. It was great. And Woodward asked him a question that I've never heard a journalist ask, and I loved it. So I love to ask people this question. It's part of the impetus for Soul Butter is what is, and can you imagine this? What is your, imagine him asking, what is your invisible power? Just out of nowhere, he just says, what is your invisible power? Because it takes you, it sort of takes you outside the liturgy, and it's before the philosophy. It really addresses, it goes right to where you're talking. What is your invisible power, and how do
Oh
you?
my gosh. That's a, I mean, I grew up in a world where you're not supposed to pat yourself on the back. You know, you're not supposed to compliment yourself and all of that sort of thing. You know, my invisible power, I don't know how to answer that question, man. This is not what you're looking for probably, but I would say my invisible power is my mom, if anything. You know, it's the relationship that I had with her, especially throughout her elderly years and her illnesses. It's the lessons that I've learned from her. It's my mother's strength. She has always been able to do what's right because it's right, no matter what the cost. I get, you know, that's my, what I think is my greatest power is not so invisible. I think is my voice, you know, and the willingness to use it when I know I'm going to get slapped around for using it, when I'm going to be attacked for it. Boy, that's, I got to think about that. You know what, you know, I, you know, I, you know what, I hope that my invisible power is an open heart, because if I have an open heart, that means that as a Republican, I can listen to Democrats. As a mother, I can listen to my children. As a spouse, I can listen to my husband. As a, you know, as a sibling, I can listen to my brothers and my sisters. So if I have an open heart, then at least I'm available to the possibilities, you know? And I think that that's something that we, that ch completely changes the way that I can address problems, people, love, hurt, disappointment, success. So I hope that that's my invisible power. I try it throughout. Politics has, I've said this to, tried to explain this to my kids. Politics has been damaging to me, and it's not something most people understand, because they see you on television saying something either that they agree with and they're applauding, or they disagree with and they're, you know, they want to track down where you live and come pound on your door, which has happened to me. So it just, you know, and so it, you know, it has been hurtful to me in ways, in friendships that I've lost and ways that I've been attacked, things like that. But I have not allowed that to change the way or the degree to which or that I love the people I love, my willingness to love, the country that my, the, my commitment to the country that I love. You know, I can go through all the different examples. And so I really do think that I think that so much of what we do in life is about keeping an open heart. And that's the first step to really embracing all the possibilities that the world and our faith and our democracy, all these different influences in our lives, have to offer.
That's a beautiful answer, and I think that I'm in total agreement with you. I just think it is the source of all good things. You know, it's where the love is. It's where the rest is. It's where the peace is. It's where the motivation
Absolutely.
comes from. And do you think that your beautiful answer? Do you think that your family background and upbringing, as you have shared, has something to do with your ability to not be rattled. You were talking about when you go out to the good fight. Or is it within just you that you know Is that a knowing within you, or do you, how much do you think the fact that you're supported in your character, if you will, in
well,
your,
there's no, it's a combination for sure. There's no question that, you know, when I first decided to run for Congress, the first person I called was my dad. And I love my dad passionately. I know how much he loves me, but we've always had a little bit of a crustier relationship, or through a certain point in our lives, you know, a little more challenging relationship than I had with my mom. But he was the first person that I called to say, I've decided I'm going to do this. And the first thing he said is, great. You would be great at that, Jennifer. And God, so, you know, there's knowing that I've always had that in my life. That absolutely, that's formative, right? That's formative of who we are and who we can become. My ability to take on the fight without getting rattled, or with, you know, to use your phrase, or to really get out there and get into it. That's something that develops over time. I couldn't have done it in my 20s or my 30s, you know, and it's something that really grew over time. And I ran for office for the first time when I was 44, but I could never have taken on what I have taken on in the 2020 cycle and this cycle when I was 44. I wasn't there yet. So much of it's such a combination. It is about having, and I have to tell you, my husband, you know, we just stumbled on each other in life. And
Bill,
he is the
we
most,
talk about Bill.
Bill, yes, we're talking about Bill. I can't think about having a person in my life who is more supportive and more, you know, more celebratory about what he sees as being my strengths and my beauty and my, you know, whatever it is. And I feel the same way about him. So there are these relationships that we bring into our lives have so much impact on, you know, these relationships that are inside our world have so much impact on what we can do outside when we step outside of our own little personal world. So it's, I think it's just a combination of all of it.
Well, you certainly are having an impact. And you know, I wanted to bring up Bill. I saw his name mentioned. Yeah. And how he rolls with all this. So that's very cool.
He's fantastic. When I ran for Congress twice, and I can't count how many millions of hours he spent standing in the back of a room while people were trying to talk to me, or I was giving a speech, or what at a debate, whatever it is, just standing in the back of the room so I could see him. I just knew he was there. And he was just wonderful, just wonderful.
That's
and yeah, so it's not easy being the partner of somebody who is really involved in politics in any way. So because a lot of that incoming that the individual takes ends up being spread out on your partner and your family. And that was something I'll say, that was something I didn't understand when I first got involved. I knew that I was up to it. I did not understand the degree to which, you know, that scattershot would hit my kids, for example. And so I, you know, that's something that I really regret about politics. I do look back and say, I wish I'd waited until they were all adults to get involved. But again, you know, it has strengthened us in so many ways.
And you've learned from that. I mean, we can't, we also live in a paradigm, in a programming that tells us we need to know something before we get the manual. You know, the manual is the lesson, right? To get the life lesson. And one of the nice things about having decades to look at, that it gives you a wealth of what I call wisdom that I think is very hip and happening in today's world.
I agree.
You know, you don't leave your shoes because you have a grounding in something that is, I think it's pretty cool. And I think we need to make, I think we need to make more out of that, you know, so the wisdom.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think we need to be better to ourselves. We need to give ourselves more credit. You know, end up at the same place in the end. We get there by different paths. We learn different lessons as we go, you know, where, you know, that's one of the great things that we should be embracing about community, you know, and that, you know, how powerful we can be when we're kinder, when we're more generous to each other and to our evaluation of each other. So I think you're really just hitting it, you know, hitting the nail on the head, as they say, so powerfully.
Yeah, it's a kind of thing that is what we focused on, what we could be focused on, could give us so much more, right? And I talk to you all day, Jennifer. I'd like to invite you to come back. Maybe we can get together again before it's all over. Would you be interested in joining us again?
I'd be happy to. Okay. I'd be happy to. Sure. I appreciate the opportunity I really believe that these kinds of conversations slowly change the world, mm-hmm. where we can just sit back and be honest with the other, be ourselves, be authentic, and focus on the things that are deeply, that we care about deeply, that are deeply powerful in our lives, as opposed to the legislative disagreements, the policy disagreements, the things that, you know, are getting people so angry with each other and worked up. We got to set that aside and have more of this, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's the kind of thing that is the content of who we are. Like you talked about your voice, you know, your voice is what you see is what you offer, your voice and your message. And for just one more thought about girls growing up and coming up and students in the world that are looking for role models because we're not giving them enough, you know, they're thrown into this politic
with absolutely
gun violence and God knows, you know, the backpacks, no more lockers. They're going to all need chiropractors by the time they get to high school because of the books they're carrying on their bed. You know, there's just not enough we're putting on. I mean,
right.
So what would your thought be to a young lady coming up in the world and what you've discovered there, if you were to think of one thing just in a footnote to suggest?
Don't give up on yourself. Don't give up on yourself. You are the power. You are the love. You are the kindness and the compassion and the generosity that you are seeking and that you can feel lacking in this world. Don't give up on yourself. Don't undervalue yourself. That's what I would say. But when you ask that question about, you know, young girls coming up in the world today, I can't help but also think about the political world that you and I are very active in. And so I would take it a step further and say, don't let go. Don't allow yourself to be pushed back. Mm-hmm. The big struggles, the big arguments, that the big debates that women are part of in the political world in which we live right now are not about a single action. They are about autonomy and control. And when I say that, people right away are thinking about abortion. It's not just about that. That's about a single act or a single issue. It is about the decades and the centuries that women have spent clawing their way to an even plane that we barely have right now. And we don't have to go way down that path. But I just had this conversation with my oldest son. Mm-hmm. I am 60 years old. I remember that my mother could not get credit without my father's permission. It wasn't until 1974, Suze, that women were legally protected to get credit cards of their own right, on their own income, their own whatever. There's so much of that in the world today that women are at risk of losing. It's up to so young women out there, do not give up on yourselves. Do not let go of what you have and what you deserve to have.
Thank you very much. We want to thank Jennifer Horn for joining us today. Your amazing presence, your remarkable journey is a light in our world. And let's call this part one. We'll do part two. And why don't we take in the next week or so a deeper dive into the voice of women and wisdom and girls and these kinds. Let's do that. Let's have that.
I'd love to talk to you about women. Let's do it. Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
Thank you so much for having me, Suze. This has really been delightful.
It's really a pleasure. And to our listeners, you can look for this on YouTube as well as your favorite podcast location at Suze Muse Studio TV. You can check out notes in the coming week on Suze Muse Studio for the full story with links to places where heroes tread. And I appreciate you all coming to this edition of Soul Butter, a tiny talk about big things. Light notes from the Suze Muse. See you next time.